Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your archive of the ephemeral of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. We're here today. We're going to talk about Sophie. As you probably know, Sophie died right at the end of January. Sophie was 34. And died in an accident in Athens, where Sophie'd been living. Look, it's early. We're in February in 2021. I feel like on Popcast, we've already done a lot of mourning, right? We did a lot of mourning last year. We've already done a bunch this year on Popcast. And I was a little hesitant or a little stressed about doing more mourning. There are so many things to feel anxiety and angst and sadness about. But I will say, every time I listen to Sophie, both before this tragic accident and since, I feel ecstatic. I feel exuberant. I feel joyful. I feel optimistic and hopeful and pure. And when we're talking about Sophie today, I think that's really what's going to emerge from the conversation is the potential to feel free. And I think the more we listen, the freer we're going to feel, the more joyful we're going to feel, the more hopeful we're going to feel. So a couple folks calling in today. Sasha Geffen is calling in. Sasha wrote a book, came out last year. It's called Glitter Up the Dark: How Pop Music Broke the Binary. Sasha writes for Pitchfork, The Nation, Art Forum, and interviewed Sophie back in 2017 for Vulture, one of the important profiles of Sophie. Also shouts to JP, who's not here today, but JP has written extensively about Sophie, including a great profile. Also, Phil Sherburn is calling in. I should say both Sasha and Phil, first time on Popcast, my bad, but I'm happy to have both of them. Phil is a longtime chronicler of electronic music. He's a contributing editor at Pitchfork and has written extensively about Sophie and associated scenes. So we're going to talk about Sophie and exuberance and identity and productions that are Sophie songs and productions for other people and productions for super famous people and ways in which the component parts that Sophie spent so much energy, time, and creativity building up, often from, relatively speaking, scratch, end up becoming the foundational blocks that so much of what we are excited about today uses as grounding. So joining us, it's Phil Sherburn, it's Sasha Geffen. Hello. Hello to both of you. Welcome to Popcast.
Thanks for having us both.
Hello. So glad to be here.
I'm extremely pumped to have both of you here. The story that we're here to talk about is really important, really polyvalent, a lot going on. Before we get specifically to Sophie, I do want to say, from a podcast perspective, this is perhaps the vastest geographic spread of guests that we have had on one episode, and certainly at one time. So, Sasha, you are in Colorado, correct?
That's right. Yep.
Can you sage podcast for a second? Give us a little bit of vibe. What's the energy like in Colorado?
It's really cold and really sunny, and everyone is just like in the house, basically.
Is it a soothing kind of quiet, or is it an anxiety-inducing kind of quiet? Like, what's the energy?
My personal energy is pretty calm and soothed, I'd say. So I lived in Chicago before I moved out to Denver, and I would say that, like, in general, the energy is a little bit more gentle here. And that's been true even over the past year, like, even though, like, things are obviously more anxious and, like, stressful than they've been ever, really, I'm kind of glad to be stranded here in Colorado, where at least I can, like, drive an hour and, like, be on a mountain, as opposed to...
That sounds nice.
Yeah, as opposed to, like, a city like Chicago in particular, which is just, like, in the middle of a lot of plains, and it's a little bit more of a struggle to, like, get into, like, nature, I guess.
Well, I'm soothed hearing you discuss that. So that's, you know, it's not, that's not for nothing.
Yeah, anytime you need me to tell you about mountains, I'm happy to.
That's a win. I hope everybody who's listening feels a little bit calmer now that they've heard that. And I know they're going to be super calm hearing Phil talk about España. Phil, you're not our first European-based call-in guest, but you may have perhaps the most bucolic arrangement of any call-in guest from Europe we've had. Can you talk to people about where you're at right now?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that I'm probably representing the smallest island you've had on your show. I live on Menorca, which is a little island in the Baleares off the coast of Spain. Better known islands here are Mallorca and, of course, Ibiza. Yeah, Menorca.
Gotta say it with the th.
It feels weird if I say it the other way. It's like my tongue cramps up if I say it without the th. Yeah, I've been here for almost 3 years now. It's kind of a random place to be, certainly for somebody that writes about music and electronic music, because there's nothing is happening here. But my wife grew up here, and we have now a 5-year-old daughter, and we were living in Barcelona. And at some point, Barcelona was getting really expensive, and it was getting very, you know, when you have a kid, everything seems very dirty to you. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, the park, it's full of, you know, it's full of dog poo, and don't touch that, cars. And our lease was up on our apartment, and they were going to raise the rent, something terrible. And we're like, why don't we go to an island? And so, yeah, we did. It's population 90,000 here. And honestly, like, we couldn't have chosen better, because with the whole pandemic thing, being on a very small island, it turns out to be a good place to be.
So we have mountain calm, we have island calm, and we are about to talk about the uproarious, joyful, orderly chaos of Sophie, which I hope rings out and wrecks the calm in your surroundings and explodes the calm in your surroundings. I want to talk first, Sasha, about some big picture understanding of the Sophie sound. Can you kind of talk to us about what Sophie was doing sonically that really felt unique and that people were gravitating to so clearly?
So Sophie's first breakthrough single came out in 2013, and that was a year and a summer, I think, in particular, where a lot of the big, like, chart-topping or, like, big charting songs were a little bit dour or a little bit muted, or were songs about, like, not being pop songs, right? Like, that was the year of Lorde and Royals. That was the year of Thrift Shop. That was, like, when Macklemore started coming up.
Wow.
Yeah. And, like,
you're really uncovering all the trauma.
I know. I went back and I listened to Thrift Shop in preparation for this, and I was like, I cannot believe that this was a hit.
It's a wild time. 2013 was wild.
Yeah. You had Drake coming up with Started From the Bottom, like all these beats that had a lot of, like, kind of muted qualities and had a lot of negative space and were a little bit, like, bleak or nostalgic. Like Bruno Mars was also big on the charts, and he's someone whose work depends a lot on nostalgia. Even like Rihanna had a summer that was like dominated by this ballad she did with Mickey Echo called Stay. So it wasn't like fun club Rihanna. It was like kind of sad Rihanna. And so in the middle of all that comes this single that has these really bright, expressive, pitched up, processed vocals, and is just really like tuned into the ecstatic pleasure of pop, and is like really straightforward about like being a pop song that's designed to give pleasure, as opposed to like thematically songs like Royals and Thrift Shop are about like not being a pop star. They're about like not living that like extravagance. And so you get this kind of like weird friction of like, this is an extremely popular song. Like this is a song that is designed to shoot up the charts and like make people rich, but it's pretending like it's just like being sung by a normal person.
Whereas you have this Sophie song, Bip, that, I mean, it's a pop song. It's not a popular song. You know, it's a known song amongst the cognoscenti, but it's not a popular song in the pure sense.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like not just the cognoscenti. I would say it also had like a club life.
That's cognoscenti to me.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah. I mean, I encountered it as like a music writer, you know, who's like very much reviewing lots of tracks and kind of like listening to things on the computer and writing about things on the computer. But like, I also think that this song had like a life in the world, in the club space, in drag spaces. Like it very quickly went out into the world and like reached people. So it wasn't like a chart hit, but in certain channels, it got a lot of attention.
Doesn't come completely out of nowhere. Talk about what does it mean to make music that is exuberant and novel and joyful in that way.
Well, I think one of the things that's really interesting about it in 2013 is it does in some sense kind of come out of nowhere. I mean, yeah, it comes from a tradition of, you could kind of loosely lump it in with what they call bass music, which was sort of a tradition of like what had been dubstep, like UK dubstep, not the US Skrillexy, what they call bro step, but the more serious, brooding, bass heavy stuff that was UK dubstep. But then that kind of morphed into this thing they didn't know what to call. The rhythms changed. It just got called bass music. And then everything just kind of scattered to the winds. And so in some sense, Sophie and Bip came out of that. But if you look back at what was happening in club music in 2013, like nothing else sounds like it. You had Daft Punk's Get Lucky was like the big crossover thing, you know, a big retro disco song. Retro was everywhere. Like in the underground, people like Paul Wolford were doing kind of retro breakbeat, drum and bass, jungle, Gulcher Lustwerk, an American deep house producer, was doing this very, not like expressly retro, but still analog, deep house, very moody. I'm looking through like the top tracks of the year on Resident Advisor, which is like a kind of undergroundish DJ site. And everything was quite moody, quite understated, very much concerned with like kind of the authenticity of its origins and its sources. Maybe the only real exception there is you had a lot of footwork stuff that was breaking through. I mean, you had like DJ Rashad's I Don't Give a F, you know, and this was the stuff that sounded like the future. And then there was Sophie. And Sophie, really, it was this, when we talk about the exuberance of it, you know, the mood was different than pretty much anything else in dance music. The mood in dance music was quite like a heads down affair. And this was like giddy. It was like, you know, huffing helium and laughing gas. Yeah, I don't know how else to explain it.
And what do we know, whether from interviews or whatnot, what do we know about Sophie's choices to make music? That wasn't intentional. But what do we know about those choices to make music that sounded like this? Sasha, you spoke to Sophie, and we've all read a bunch of interviews. What did Sophie say about these choices to do music that sounded like this?
There's a 2013 interview, I think even before Bip came out, where Sophie talks about wanting to make music that cuts against nostalgia, that has like no interest whatsoever in like clinging to any kind of past artifact. It's only looking forward. And it's interesting to think of BIP as coming out as in the same year as Random Access Memories, the album by Daft Punk, which is this really big, glossy, nostalgic affair, right? That was very successful critically and commercially because it was very recognizable in a lot of ways.
Low-key dull? I don't know, question mark.
Oh, I thought it was so boring. At the time, I know it was like a really hot album and like in a lot of ways, but like I just could not do it.
I really struggled with that album. No, that was like a good example of an album where like a lot of sensible people that I know were kind of like, this album is incredible. Like this is just the textures and the nostalgia, you know, and the callbacks and nostalgia. And I'm listening to it and I was like, it's like Office House, like I don't, it's like you want to give a little bit of deference, like okay, it's Daft Punk, you know, it's Daft Punk, I'm on board, and then it's like actually this can go.
Yeah, and I think it was like so oversaturated too. It's like you could not go anywhere without hearing Get Lucky in like the whole world. It was like in the grocery store, it was like in every mix, you know, it was just like grocery everywhere.
It's Office House, it's grocery store house.
So I think like that provides like a good counterexample to what Sophie wanted to do with those early singles and with some of the later music too, was to think in a really granular way about like how to like think about music from the individual piece up, like what happens if we start with a synthesizer sound that doesn't really sound like any preset, you know, what happens if you bend a waveform until it sounds really surprising and fresh, and then kind of like work piece by piece to make a whole song that sounds surprising and new and fresh, like in the tradition of like a decades long history of synthesis and in many, many different genres. Like this music didn't come from nowhere, but I think Sophie was someone who was really invested in sound at the most like particulate level.
If there are earlier reference, which is to say not like the year before, but maybe 10 years before or 20 years before, you know, I think about obviously rave music, like actual like candy rave type stuff, happy hardcore. Sometimes when I would hear those early Sophie songs, I would get that kind of similar jolt from hearing those forms of music and be like, wow, the component parts are unusual and the way that they're being jammed together is completely disconnected from all the other stuff I'm hearing. And I found that really refreshing because, you know, I mean, you do this job long enough and you just feel like you've seen every move, right? You've heard every move, every juxtaposition. And it was so nice to encounter a juxtaposition or a tonality or something that felt like, huh, okay. Haven't heard that in a minute or at all.
I feel like the happy hardcore vocals and like the really bright synth sounds are like a touchstone. Sophie was obviously really influenced by Autechre. I also hear a lot in like 80s, 90s, 2000s R&B production and hip hop production, just in terms of like really bright, juicy sounds making up those beats.
I was thinking about like, for lack of a better term, like the digital R&B of the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm, like Dark Child and like a lot of those producers who worked with like Destiny's Child and Maya and Brandy, like that whole wave of like really clipped, artificial, like futuristic sounding music.
Sort of like post Missy and Timbaland R&B, basically. Mm-hmm.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Someone who I don't know on Spotify put together a playlist, and the playlist is called Every Sophie Produced Song on This Damn Site. The user's name is Evan McNeil. This may be the only good music journalism in 2021. Someone who went through all of Spotify and put this all in one place. So thank you to this person. And to your point, Sasha, there are a couple songs. I'm wishing that I could remember the specific ones, but there were two or three songs deep in this playlist that very specifically felt like early 2000s mainstream R&B to me, like digital R&B. So it's very, very clear as a touchstone for sure.
I also hear a lot of like freestyle and some of the early stuff too, like the I Can Make You Feel Better, that hook always makes me think of like Connie's Funky Little Beat or something like that, which is interesting then because when Autechre recently remixed the Sophie song a month or so ago, that had also a very freestyle feel to it, kind of bringing things full circle.
Can we talk about how quickly what Sophie did in BIP, how quickly did that start to pollinate? How fast was that?
Well, I don't know if BIP was acting alone because like PC Music started putting out its first singles at the time, like the British net label PC Music, whose members Sophie worked extensively with. Like a lot of those early tracks by like A.G. Cook and Lip Gloss Twins and Hannah Diamond, like those started popping up around the same time. And while there are some notable formal differences, I think, between all those artists and their production styles, I think there is this like common emphasis on the bright and the shiny and a similar way of treating vocals, like pitching them up and like kind of adding some sheen there. So I think that whole wave started to spread fairly quickly, but it maybe took like a couple years before you had that sound moving into charting pop, if that makes sense. Maybe like a year or two. I'm trying to think of when that Madonna album was.
Well, I think that first Sophie compilation is 2015, I'm pretty sure. So I feel like it's 2014 into 2015 where you're really starting to see if it's a scene, quote unquote, or an idea or an ideology really starting to coalesce right around then, I think.
The Madonna album with Sophie production credit also came out in 2015. So I want to say it took maybe like a year and a half, 2 years.
And we will get to that Madonna. We are not going to get out of this episode without addressing this Madonna song. Let's talk about artificiality. And also the artificiality of artificiality. Because one thing that, especially when you start to get to the Lemonade era and this kind of tension between extremely accessible, quote unquote, mainstream things and oppositional art and, you know, PC Music, kind of maybe they're gaming the system, maybe they're not. Once you kind of arrive at that point, to me, I was always a little bit puzzled because I always felt like that was so clear in the project of Sophie, like before we sort of arrive at the can Lemonade be used in a McDonald's commercial question, it always seemed very clear that part of the Sophie project especially was to explode what the notion of what people perceived as quote unquote artificial was. How did that strike y'all at the time? Because it seemed like a strange retrograde argument to be having in 2015 when I felt like it was already being addressed in like 2013 and 2014. Phil, how did that strike you at the time?
It's funny because I think in some ways I got Sophie wrong in the beginning because For instance, that Hey Cutie project, or QT, with A.G. Cook, and who was the other person on that? There was a PC Music project.
Hayden Dunham was the performer.
Yeah. So Hey QT was a kind of a PC Music, I don't know if they released it or if it was PC Music adjacent, but it was kind of a theme song for an imaginary energy drink, right? And so, and it had like a product shot and it had a video. And I, at the time, I thought it was kind of a little empty. I didn't really, I mean, I was curious about the PC Music stuff, but to me, it seemed like if this is where it was going to be a dead end, just for my, like my own prejudices about what makes for like real art. I mean, I'm like far from a popist, you know? And the stuff that I found really interesting was what Sophie was doing with like with pure texture and with like the sonics of the music, which we've talked about quite a bit. And that kind of treatment of artificiality, I thought was really interesting, was like really creating kind of an artificial sort of soundscape from scratch. You know, this music that didn't refer back to anything else, either stylistically or in terms of pure sonics.
Sasha, what was your vibe on it at that time?
I had so much fun listening to that song. I was delighted that it just kind of went for the pure sugar pleasure of like pop music, and that it also seemed to play with a lot of like performance art and like drag conventions. Like I saw a QT live set at South By in 2015, and it was like a whole thing, like Hayden lip sync to the song, but there was also like this like voiceover track. And I wish I could remember better, like what was said, like the actual text of it. But it was just kind of like playing with the concept of something like advertising as a genre and not being precious about like severing art and music from advertising, because I think like, it's kind of like past that in a lot of ways. Like culture is not in a place where any of us can engage with a world that is free of advertising. I mean, I hear these early singles, especially as kind of commenting on the fact that we're all connected digitally through advertising networks, right? Like a lot of the people that I like befriended over my love of Sophie and PC Music or like through Twitter, which is an ad network. It like analyzes our communications to sell us things. Like it's so embedded. And I hear something like Hey Cutie, not as just like cynically accepting that, but as something that's like curious about that. It's like, how did we get here? Why does this work so well? Like, why does advertising work as well as it does when it comes to organizing people and like manipulating behavior and like causing people to act or move in a certain way? Because it's like, it's an extremely effective social force. Like it works really, really well.
And it's, and Sophie's, what Sophie was doing at that time was really centering that as subject matter, whether literal or kind of metaphorical. And it's important, I think, sometimes to point out the things that were being discussed or alluded to in these Sophie songs at this era that people were kind of like getting up in arms about for whatever reason. A lot of your faves who are not Sophie, a lot of your faves are out here making songs that they hope will be picked up in ads. They just don't talk about it. It's not baked into their narrative. It's not something that they share, but certainly in songwriting rooms, whether it's in Nashville or Los Angeles or Miami or wherever, people are not immune to writing music that they hope will be chart popular and potentially also licensing lucrative.
Totally. Like indie rock was huge in advertising like a few years before. Like I remember hearing Modest Mouse songs and like car ads. It's like
weird.
Modest Mouse was all about that ad life, you know? They were like, sure, let's license it. Let's like get us that money. And I mean, I'm sure it bothered people. I'm sure there were like arguments about it, but you don't think of like,
well, luckily for me, I don't think of Modest Mouse at all.
Yeah, I've since stopped doing so, thankfully. But, that period's over for me. But like when I was a teenager, they were very present.
So we're talking about the mid-2010s, and this is also coinciding with essentially the slow emergence of Sophie into the light. Because for those early years, there really aren't photos of Sophie on the internet. Sasha, when you and I were chatting a tiny bit yesterday, you were sort of talking about social media and like how Sophie was either not using social media or social media was being used to kind of almost maybe, I forget exactly how you phrased it. Maybe this is a good time for you to jump in and express it, because I thought you really were nailing it in our conversation yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, there were like Sophie accounts, right? Like Twitter accounts, and there's like a website, but it was pretty minimal. I think like the extent of Sophie's public biography was like this squiggly text, like white text on black background on the website that was just like, hi, my name is Sophie. And like, that was it as far as biography or like personal details. It's just like you had this name and you had this font that was very specific. And then you had the music. And in retrospect, I think it was really effective because the music itself and those early singles like Bip, Lemonade, Hard kind of gestured to maximalist pop expressions, right? Like you can kind of hear those songs as coming out of the Nicki Minaj, Lady Gaga, Beyonce era around 2010, like these larger than life figures. And some of those sounds kind of migrate directly into those early Sophie songs. But then there's just this like total absence of like persona. And it's like, what happens when it's just the music that is kind of like gesturing to this structure that we're all familiar with, but like completely excises like the diva from it?
When did that change? And why do you think that changed, whether based on your observation or your conversation with Sophie that you had when you were profiling?
It changed in 2017, in fall of 2017. Sophie had never used third person pronouns before in any kind of like press materials or bios or anything like that. And I mean, plenty of the media used third person pronouns for Sophie, but it was kind of like based on an assumption that turned out to be incorrect. And so in, I think it was October 2017, there was this press release with a press photo of Sophie, the first one, and it used she, her pronouns for the first time. So there was this moment of like arriving as an image as well as a sound. And it accompanied the song It's Okay to Cry, which
we played at the top of the show.
Yeah. Yeah. And that came out with Sophie's first ever music video, where Sophie is standing in front of this animated background with like a hyper real sky that like changes and mutates very quickly. And it's a ballad. It doesn't sound at first like a lot of the really kinetic plasticine early singles. It's a little bit more slow. And then Sophie is doing vocals for the first time on a Sophie song. Like Sophie didn't sing Sophie songs
right
before that.
Which we didn't, right. And we should have specified that before this. But all the songs that we've talked about up until this point are Sophie produced songs, not Sophie performed vocally songs.
Right. There were a lot of uncredited guest vocalists who did those vocals on the early tracks. But It's Okay to Cry is Sophie singing for the first time. And I think there are guest vocalists at the end, at the climax of the song. But it changed the tone of the conversation completely, because all of a sudden there's this person here. And, you know, Sophie never came out in the traditional way and actually didn't like that term, because... And I kind of agree, because I think it maybe refers to an older model of like queerness in the world, maybe a little bit 20th century. And, you know, I mean, people still have to like conceal things about themselves, but things are maybe a little bit more complicated now in a lot of ways. But like, this was someone that people had made assumptions about. And then suddenly like Sophie was there to kind of clear away all that and to be introduced as not just a producer, but as a performer with this really magnetic presence on camera and on stage. Like, I mean, I think anyone who had seen Sophie live before that, like, could pick up on that, but having it in music video form was really powerful, considering the absence of anything like that, of any kind of like imagery around Sophie as a person, as a performer.
You also tweeted right after Sophie passed about the ways in which transness and trans identity informed the music making process, and how you could, in essence, hear that in the music and in the production choices. And what you said was, I think what I've been trying to figure out how to say for the past 7-8 years is that Sophie's music isn't just about, quotes, transness. Its idiom is inherently trans. It traces the process of surfacing interiority. The impact of Sophie isn't just representation. It's that she had started to figure out how to translate these hidden processes of perceiving and becoming into music. I wonder if you can expand upon that. I know you told me you're writing something longer that's going to be coming out, but I wonder if you can expand on that just a touch, because I thought that was a really moving way to put it.
I think that Sophie's early singles were connected really immediately to a lot of gay and trans people because of how they sounded. Like, I mean, obviously there was the gesture of like the picking the name Sophie. Like, that's already information, right? Like, that's a communication of sorts. And yeah, I think that was like part of what I responded to. But also the treatment of the vocals, looking at femininity as something that is artificial, not just for trans people, but for everyone. Like, looking at gender is something that is not fixed, but is like a kind of a communication technology almost. It's like a shared language that we use to communicate something of our interiority. And everyone does that, you know, like not just trans people. That is like a common language. It's just that it's maybe not commented on or reflected upon in the same way if it's just kind of like default, you know, if you're just like going, you know, if you identify with the gender that everyone told you should have, it's like maybe not worth thinking about or talking about. But if there's some amount of conflict there or friction, then there's this opportunity to kind of like see where that's coming from, like what the difference is between like how you feel and how you exist in the world. And I think you have to like dive pretty deep into your own interiority for that. And I think the process of digging into synthesis as a form of communication, like going deep into silence and then filling it with a raw waveform and then sculpting that waveform really, really deliberately, really carefully until it becomes something new. I see a parallel between that and like figuring out what the language of gender is. Like, what am I feeling? Why am I responding to images of like other people doing gender in the way that I am? And how can I like dig deep into that impulse and like try to hold it in a way that's communicative, like dredge that up and like bring it into the world and like mold the self in a way that makes the world make more sense. Just like that process of digging into the interior of the self and like surfacing what you find there and like bringing it out so that other people can see it.
So we're arriving at 2017, 2018. 2018 is when the first Sophie solo album comes out, and that's Oil of Every Pearl's On Insides. Phil, what were you hearing in this album that was expanding the Sophie sound? What did this album do that the singles were building blocks towards?
It's almost like, what doesn't it do? Because it begins with It's Okay to Cry, which is this very, I think I described it as like a middle school slow dance song, because it has these like chiming kind of digital synths, and it's very sentimental. And then immediately after that, it goes into Pony Boy, which is just hard and abrasive and sexual and kinky and sonically just incredibly intense. Face Shopping is the same.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to listen to Face Shopping, because Face Shopping is a wild song. I love this song. Okay, let's listen to a little Face Shopping.
Face Shopping and everything on this album, I hear just kind of continuing to build on the like very textural, very tactile foundation of the early stuff, but also digging much further into rhythm. And I guess the shock tactics, and I don't mean that in a like a basic way of like, oh, singing about kink or something like that, but like the sonically, you know, these are songs that really like grab you by the lapels and shake you back and forth. They're very, very intense. And for somebody that had been doing stuff with Madonna and doing big pop records than to be doing like a full on noise record. I've been trying to think of other artists that kind of ran that gamut, you know, that could do like the biggest chart pop and then could also do a straight up noise record. And I don't know, Sasha, can you think of anybody else that's really occupied both spaces kind of as fully as Sophie?
You know, artists that come to mind are kind of like 80s synth pop. Like I'm thinking about like how Soft Cell like had a hit record and also worked with Coil, but not to quite the same degree. But I think there was like a precedence there between like kind of the underground sound and like the big pop sound in 80s synth pop specifically.
This is probably a good time to talk about those bigger pop collaborations, which means, yes, it is time to listen to Bitch on Madonna. So here's a little bit of that. So Sasha, as you mentioned, this is, I believe, 2015, correct?
Yes.
So Madonna out here in touch with the youth, identifying exciting things that are happening. This is probably the first non-PC Charlie kind of big thing that Sophie's done. Is that right?
Well, it was before the first Charlie collaboration.
Oh, wow. Damn.
So that was Vroom Vroom. That was 2016.
So what do we make of this Madonna, Sophie, and Nicki collaboration?
Well, it kind of feels like things are coming full circle in a sense, because I hear a lot of Nicki in early Sophie PC Music singles, just that bright, distended femininity and that like kind of surreal visuals that accompanied a lot of Nicki songs. So that's kind of fun. But I also hear like Sophie and Diplo maybe like clashing a little bit.
Yeah.
I can't imagine why that would happen.
Yeah. It's kind of like a strange group of people in the same room.
It's like a classic kind of like weird night in the Los Angeles studio where it's like, you know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, this person's here and also this person's here. And I guess we are now doomed to make music together. Maybe, you know, I don't know what the TikTok of this song being made was. I don't know if it was all in one session or if it was in multiple people sending files back and forth. It doesn't quite cohere in the way that, say, other Sophie stuff coheres.
I think it's a little disjointed, but it's fun.
It's definitely fun. If I didn't know it was Madonna, I don't know that I would have known it was Madonna.
Well, she does say so.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, apart from the announcement.
I mean, so you know.
Yes.
But you know when Diplo comes in.
That's how they came up with the lyrics. They're like, you should probably say that you're Madonna at some point here. Yeah, just for the record. Just lay it down for the record. My question following this song is, at the time, did it seem like this was going to portend some genuinely huge pop producer breakthrough for Sophie, or was it so kind of like particular and idiosyncratic that it kind of actually more brought Madonna and Nicki back into Sophie world than bringing Sophie into Madonna and Nicki world?
I don't know. I mean, I think like Sophie's solo work probably portended a lot of the more interesting collaborations that Sophie did more than the Madonna track. You know, like there's a lot of stuff that's just like not out yet, but there's collaborations with Rihanna, there's collaborations with Lady Gaga. And I want to say that those are likely based on the strength of Sophie's solo work more so than the session for Madonna, just because I don't see Sophie's full range on display and the full expressiveness of Sophie's production.
But there are other collaborations that Sophie did with sort of like more well-known or more widely known names that I think did take advantage of like the full Sophie. You know, I think the Vince Staples stuff feels to me like those are real Sophie records that Vince Staples happens to rap on as songs. They are real Sophie songs.
Vince talked about like it, you know, he doesn't just happen to rap on them. I think that it was like a little bit more of a collaborative process.
Right. I mean, I really hear the Sophiness in them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they were a really good fit. I think they had a really good communication between them. They had maybe a similar sense of humor.
Yes, I think that's probably right. Let's listen to Yeah Right, which is one of those songs off of Vince's Big Fish Theory. Boy, yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah, right. Boy, yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah, right. Boy, yeah, right, yeah, right.
nice? Is your girl fat? Is you well paid? Are your shows packed? If your song played, would they know that?
Also, when I was going through this playlist, which again is a tremendous public service, I was not up on ITZY 24 Hours by ITZY, a K-pop girl group. Y'all up on this?
I was not until this playlist.
Very cool song. Really, really into it. Let's just listen to a little bit of that as well. K-pop often has its own kind of mayhemish exuberance, and this really kind of like unites that source material and Sophie source material to really amplify, really, really strong approve on that. One thing that I feel like unfortunately has been happening the last 2 weeks is you're seeing so many people talk about how influential Sophie was. There was a great tweet that went around, and I'm going to mangle the language of it, and I feel bad, but basically like, your favorite producer couldn't like release their entire sample pack and still be the best at doing.
Yeah.
Does anybody remember the specific language in that tweet?
That was Benny Blanco, right?
Was it Benny?
I think it might've been, because I know Benny was talking about the way Sophie worked with, like they went into the studio together, and there was kind of a box on the table. And Sophie proceeded to like wring just these incredible sounds out of it. And Benny Blanco was kind of flabbergasted, you know, like, how do you get these sounds I've never heard out of this basic piece of gear? And I think he was the one that said that thing about your producer could never, your favorite could never.
So when Sophie put out the sample pack, you know, this is something that producers will do, right?
It's something that's been going on for a long time, you know, is like they design a set of presets for a given soft synth, usually it is, or sample pack, and they release it. And I don't know how the licensing breaks down, if it's an upfront fee, if they get I'm guessing it's probably an upfront fee, but of course it's good publicity for them. They get their name out there and stuff like that. And Sophie did one.
Yeah, in 2017, I'm seeing. So there's, you know, a couple hundred, more than 200 samples and pieces to play with. What comes after that? Did that seed a generation of producers? Did that seed a generation of ideas and approaches to dance and pop and the kind of ecstatic union of the two?
I don't think that sample pack would be enough to seed that. You know, I think Sophie's work seeded itself kind of in the culture at large. I mean, I've been trying to think about people that were influenced by Sophie, not so much in the pop realm, but more in the sort of underground electronic or experimental electronic realm. And I think there's so much that wouldn't exist in the same way without Sophie's example. I mean, what Sophie did with, I keep coming back to Texture and Timbre, but also Empty Space and Silence. You see that turning up in artists like Beatrice Dillon, Error Smith, this German artist who designed his own synth, in fact, but also working with similar ideas. Lorenzo Senni, this Italian artist who does this kind of like retro rave, slightly ironic. Mark Fell, of course, has been around longer than Sophie, but still running with these ideas that Sophie kind of helped, like you said, seed into the world, you know, and populate. I think there's all kinds of stuff that just wouldn't sound the same without those records. And also without Oil of Every End and Sides. I mean, it's not just the early tracks, which are in some ways the most sort of distinctive, but what blows me away is like the daringness of Oil of Every End and Sides is that this is not the work of somebody who's kind of like dying to get asked back to make the next Madonna record, if you know what I mean. It's like, you know, it's like...
Wait, Sasha, when you spoke to Sophie, was Sophie dying to get asked back for to work on the next Madonna record? Tell us the scoop.
Sophie was thrilled that the Madonna gig paid so well that the It's Okay to Cry video could be funded adequately.
Wow.
Was it that literal? It was the one thing funded the other that cleanly?
Well, Sophie didn't mention Madonna specifically, but yes, we did talk about how a lot of those big name production gigs were able to fund the more personal work that Sophie ended up doing.
In the last week, you did a thing for Pitchfork where you interviewed a few people about Sophie's influence on them, a few other musicians. What did you take away from those conversations? What were some common threads that came through those conversations that you had?
Well, it's kind of like what Phil was saying, that, you know, the sample pack didn't really make waves. Like the waves were already made, like by those early singles and the sample pack just kind of made things easier for producers who were interested in that kind of sound. It was just kind of like, well, you're already here with me. So like, here you go. It's interesting because I talk to people across like a pretty wide variety of genres, folks working in techno, hip hop, and then like kind of experimental electronic vocal music. Lyra Pramick was someone I talked to, and she does really cool work with her voice that feels very like influenced in certain ways by Sophie treating the voice as material, like pitching it up, looping it, processing it in this way that gives it this cast of artificiality, but it is also like very clear, very direct, very communicative, which I think is important. Just the way voices sounded in really all of Sophie's work felt very singular. And whether you're a singer yourself or treating someone else's vocals or like bringing samples into like a club space, I think using like words and syllables as these really bright expressive units of feeling is something that Sophie did really well, that was really influential on a lot of people who are making electronic music now, or really like any music that plays in a similar space. I mean, it's all electronic, I guess, and that like everything's electronic, but I don't want to limit it to like this one genre or like subgenre.
And also, I mean, you know, we haven't really touched on Gex and hyperpop and things like that, but it does feel like a lot of Sophie lessons just live in there every day, kind of as default reference points.
Yeah, totally. Just like the excessive, like the joyful excesses, I think, of it really spread far, especially among like queer and trans musicians.
Something I think is really interesting about Sophie in that sense is like the joyful excess and also the willingness to combine unlike things, but without any shred of irony. And I think that was something kind of refreshing and new. I mean, there had been plenty of this kind of recombinant pop before, but a lot of it, certainly if it was coming out of more of an indie context, which is like freighted, fraught with kind of guilt about a million things, it had this ironic, like, oh, it's pop, we're not supposed to like it. But like Sophie didn't bring irony to anything. It was like, I love this, and I love this, and I love this, and I'm going to put them all together, and I'm going to see what happens when they interact.
And I also want to deliver it in a way that communicates my true joy. That's really the thing. It's like, you know, this, look, podcast, we don't care about guilty pleasure. That's not a real thing. Pleasure is pleasure. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I don't even want to like entertain the phrase, but I do think a lot of people still live with like the baggage, like you say, of that guilt of enjoying certain things. And I remember like when I was first hearing Gex stuff, thinking, ah, their relationship to pleasure feels similar to Sophie's relationship to pleasure or to joy or exuberance or whatnot. It's unashamed. It's proud. It's loud. It's a little clangorous, but also in like the best kind of like making it work with what you have at hand kind of way.
I think Gex is a band that is about like maybe like being on the computer and like listening to songs that are like 15 years old that you love, you know, like watching old Soulja Boy videos and just like kind of dissolving into that universe. And I think like the treatment of Laura's vocals in particular, this comes from a lineage that Sophia invited a lot of people to join.
I will say, as someone that's like been writing about music for a really, really long time, one of the real plus sides of the immediacy of what Sophie was doing and what's being done now, kind of in the wake of early Sophie stuff, is it really does recenter joy and enthusiasm. And I think especially as a critic, I have found it can be easy to get distanced from that via analysis or agonizing over accuracy or whatever. There's like a million things that get in the way with that direct like cortex hit of joy. And listening to this music, and even just in preparation for this, just re-listening to all this stuff, I was like, wow, it feels good to feel good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and in a way that doesn't preclude that critical vantage, I think. I actually think that like Sophie's music was about unabashed joy while also trying to figure out reality in a really deep way. It wasn't just about like getting outside all of the problems of the world, but like, what if we really like pried those open and like looked inside and like saw how they worked and also had a great time while doing so?
Big facts. Phil, Sasha, I really appreciate y'all coming through to talk about Sophie. And I hope everybody is now going to go back out in the world. Everyone who's listening, throw on BIP, get wild, feel happy, feel pleasure, and go make something beautiful with it.
Thanks so much for having me on, John.
Yeah, thank you, John.
It's been a treat.
That is our show. Thank you to Sasha and Phil for coming on and celebrating the life and career of Sophie. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get involved with the Facebook group. You can email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. As a quick sidebar, as a few of you know, because you were in the room, I did a thing on Clubhouse the other night, and I was happy to see Sam was there, Hannah was there. I was happy to see some familiar names in there. Maybe we should do a Clubhouse room where we talked about music and just kick it and play stuff and engage with each other. Let me know either by email or on the Facebook group if you guys are down. We can talk about making it a little bit more of an official thing. Our producer, who I inadvertently roped into a two-person Clubhouse room the other day, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out listening to a Sophie track from Oil of Every Pearls on Insides. This is Immaterial.